Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Hope everybody had a very happy Passover. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. More than 555,000 Americans have died during the COVID pandemic. As building confidence drives rising air travel and surging youth caseloads, lockdowns are growing across Europe, and it's unclear whether the Schengen zone will reopen as expected in mid-April. On taking office, the Biden administration promised to bring democracies together to stand up to China, and days after an acrimonious meeting between the United States and Chinese leaders in Alaska, Britain, Canada, and the EU adopted Washington sanctions, prompting a furious reaction from China, effectively ending the Beijing-Brussels trade deal before it got off the ground, at least to some observers. To curry favor with global businesses, Beijing is counting on greed to overcome principle, one of its standard economic tactics. This shifting IPOs to Hong Kong and allowing Western banks a cut of the action while also making it more enticing to do business on the mainland with less onerous and wildcard regulations. Meanwhile, Britain has issued both sweeping defense cuts as well as new investment to reshape its force for future threats, taking risk now to reduce risk later. Joining us as they do every week is our roundtable, Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago, as always. Thanks.
Always a pleasure, Vago. Thank you.
Happy Passover, Vago. Thanks for having us.
And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA, our land warfare coverage. Ron, talk to us a little bit about the broader market as you do each week and how the sector performed this week and what's driving investors, right? I mean, a lot of news flow about the relationship with China, the United States, and Europe. There's the Suez Canal closure that also is driving oil prices and other commodity prices up. Talk to us about how the sector performed this week and the broader drivers.
Yeah, sure. So you know, one of the things we've been watching is the interest rates on the 10-year. The 10-year closed the week just a hair under 1.7%. So we're at the higher end. There's discussion that maybe it goes up to 2, maybe higher, maybe not. We'll see. Something to watch. When you look at the aerospace defense sector specific on the week, it's just bellwethers. Boeing was down a little over 4%. TransDigm, just to give a flavor for maybe a company with less internal challenges, it was down 2.5% on the week. But we saw Northrop Grumman up about 3.5%, Lockheed Martin up almost 3%, and L3Harris up almost 1%. So this week we did see some, I would say, rotating from commercial aerospace into defense, and that was echoed in some of the commentary I had with investors. It seems like the investment community is doing a little bit more work on defense, and I think part of that is being catalyzed by the headlines with China, what's going on with China, maybe the increased tension in the Pacific Rim, and then also Russia kind of pops up in the conversation too. So a good week for defense, and not a great week for commercial aerospace.
And I should have pointed out, right? I mean, there was president made his case for a $3 trillion investment plan that comes on top of $1.9 trillion in stimulus spending, right? And so that's fanning concerns of inflation across markets. How is the Suez Canal impacting the dynamic, right? I mean, because that was sort of an unanticipated shock, right? Ship loses control in a sandstorm, buries its bow in the sand, and it's so massive that it's just blocking up one of the world's most important waterways.
Yeah, for sure. I would say before the Suez Canal situation, there were worries across a multitude of supply chains that as things ramp up, how are supply chains looking? There's been headlines around, chips for auto vehicles and other supply chain issues. That being said, that was before the Suez Canal, right? So with the Suez Canal situation, it just kind of aggravates the whole supply chain view. And I think, it's when you look at what's going on in the canal, it's a lot like traffic on the highway. Once they clear it up, it's still going to be backed up for a long time, right? I mean, it takes a while for all that to dissipate. So it just makes a supply chain issue that was probably a bit tenuous in the recovery even more so.
And there's a fluid dynamics term for this, isn't there?
Yes, there is. If you really want to get nerdy about it, a shockwave is a hyperbolic phenomenon, as is traffic on a highway. So it's a hyperbolic phenomenon, meaning you have a standing wave right now in the Suez Canal. And when the thing that's creating the standing wave, it takes a long time for that wave to dissipate.
And obviously carriers are thinking about going around Cape of Good Hope, right? So it's a little bit of a longer way around, right? But trade like water always finds a way. Speaking of trade, Sash, air travel is up certainly in the United States, but European outlook is still grim, right? We didn't discuss this last week, but BA is selling its headquarters. Air France is among the national carriers working with their governments on a rescue plan. Walk us through what the dynamic, air travel dynamic is over the course of the last week, where travel continued to tick up here in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. U.S. domestic air travel market, let's be absolutely clear about that, is, absolutely going gangbusters at the moment. You have probably the most, the most vibrant recovery out there. Here's the problem. International is not following, and the US, even if you get back to 2019 levels of traffic, that probably only adds about 6% to total global traffic. So it's a, it's a very important market for you and the vast majority, I suspect, of our listeners, but it doesn't actually affect the global metrics as much as we might think. Elsewhere, around the world, China has recovered, had a good recovery from the Chinese New Year mini lockdown that they had, but it's now sort of fairly stable. Our worries about China are about the very, very weak load factors of the big three there. they've put capacity on, plenty of flights, they're just not actually filling them, and they're certainly not filling them at an acceptable price. The epicenter of the pandemic in air travel terms at the moment is Europe. And specifically continental Europe, but frankly, the whole of Europe just gets dragged into this. You mentioned earlier on, will the Schengen zone reopen in April? Will it? Hell, it's much more likely, frankly, that there are further restrictions put on in Europe because COVID infection rates are going up in almost every major and a lot of the smaller mainland European countries. And not only is this causing extremely unpleasant vaccine nationalism, relations between the UK and Europe are, as bad as they've ever been during Brexit, frankly, but it just means that nobody is thinking about air travelers being a priority for a recovery, and won't do until the European vaccination programs really get going. And at the moment, they're nascent, I think would be the most charitable description there. So the optimism definitely in the US, but Europe has got worse since last week. I don't think anybody would doubt that. And that's been one of the reasons why air transport stocks over, in Europe have been very, very weak indeed. There's a worry that there are going to need to be more bailouts, and some companies just won't make the cut, because if the summer vacation period does not occur or occurs very weakly, some of these heavily leveraged businesses just won't make it through it.
And that's an issue, right? We've discussed that the national carriers will be the ones who survive, whereas all manner of commercial outfits may not be, no matter what Ryanair, for example, says about airlines being able to survive on their own devices. Richard, you are the king bull when it comes to a resurgence in air travel. Let's also talk a little bit about airline pricing and aircraft pricing and the whole dynamic that's going to go along with it, because this is not going to be a rising tide that will be lifting all boats everywhere at the same time.
Yeah, I share a number of Sash's concerns, but I'm still maintaining my rather bullish stance on the recovery of revenue passenger kilometers to the 2019 peak in late 2022. It's going to get ugly, particularly with Europe on the road there, but I still think we're getting there. What does concern me a bit is that by all estimations, you know, there's this other impressive cottage industry of people who look at aircraft pricing. And, you know, a lot of it is guesswork because it's not exactly in the public domain. And of course, list prices are, have become the greatest work of fiction around. So, you know, it, by all estimations, you know, multiple sources, pricing really took a nasty nosedive. Some of it was driven by, of course, the MAX and Boeing's need to keep people in the order book rather than canceling, which they could do because of the MAC clause that allowed them to cancel. But Airbus followed. By all accounts, they just said, yeah, well, we'll lower our pricing too, in part because we want to keep, you know, to 40 per month or whatever stated goal was. And okay, that's fine. But you've got this deflationary environment that's been in place in the jetliner business for decades now. Every year we have lost about 2% of the real value of a new jet, all the while prices for production, that is to say labor, energy, materials, have been rising. Somehow we've been managing to pull off Herculean achievements in productivity. Part of it, of course, is due to, you know, things like partnership for success or partnering for poverty or whatever, efforts to keep the supply chain cost down. That might have run its course, both at Boeing and at Airbus. So you've got this deflationary pricing dynamic kicking in. When you're going to have an economic recovery, probably, or some kind of recovery in the aftermath of the pandemic, what does it look like for jetliner manufacturing profits over the coming couple of years? Could we be in for something of a, you know, negative pressure, if not a bloodbath? It's one of those things I think we should be probably paying attention to, because even though a lot of sales prices do include some kind of inflationary clause, that's not hard and fast, not always. And you know, sometimes it just doesn't do the job of keeping up with what reality might be.
Ron and Sash, want to take either one of you want to take a bite at those, any one of those apples? Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, I would add to Richard's comments. I mean, it's, you know, you generally it's a supply and demand thing, right? So you look at aircraft, demand for aircraft obviously is soft, right? So you're in an environment where I think it would be very difficult for manufacturers to get pricing. But that said, on the raw material side, raw materials across the raw material spectrum are going up. There are, you know, clauses or price escalators based on that. So we'll see how that, you know, all plays through. But I think it would be difficult, you know, particularly if you're still working through, you know, a backlog of airplanes that's over a year late, to get price on an aircraft. So, you know, for Boeing with the MAX, an escalation in raw materials could prove yet even more kind of problematic than it would normally be because of the special situation that the MAX is in.
I want to talk a little bit about China and the evolving China dynamic, right? Everybody in this industry, I mean, we've talked about, you know, a third of the 737 MAX orders are going to China. The Chinese have yet to recertify the jet. There is obviously a lot of, right, China does use trade as a weapon on a regular basis. We've seen that aimed at Australia. And increasingly, we're seeing this aimed at the United States and its allies and partners. After the United States sanctioned Chinese leaders over Xinjiang, we saw Britain, Canada, Europe follow suit. Major manufacturers like H&M, for example, said they wouldn't use cotton from Xinjiang. The company has been effectively canceled, dropped from Chinese e-commerce platforms. There's a boycott on it. That's happened to FedEx and to Marriott and all of these other, the NBA, over these issues. And so it's clear that the Chinese are engaging in global economic warfare, which was the critics' standpoint anyway. Richard, I mean, you've been particularly concerned about what decoupling means. Decoupling is likely actually going to get worse once the Biden administration finishes its manufacturing and industrial base assessments, right, where we are clearly going to be adding some industries to, you know, whether we're going to restrict technology on it or whether we're going to try to build some of these capabilities at home, as Ron mentioned, right? A global chip demand is impeding the most, you know, most profitable auto lines, right? F-150 trucks have been slowed down because of a shortage of computer chips. How do you see this decoupling unfolding, and unfolding at a time when China is also building alliances, direct alliances, not just with Russia, not just with Iran, but nations around the world to sort of curry favor, you know, whether that's with Saudi Arabia or United Arab Emirates or any other nation the United States has criticized.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of ironic, or maybe just a, you know, serious bummer, but, you know, the mantra, I think, among China watchers during the Trump years was, you know, well, they're confronting China, but they're desperately incompetent at it. When Biden comes in, he'll be confronting China, but he'll be rather good at it. And, you know, looking back, it really was comically incompetent, you know, the idea of going straight at China without enlisting allies. The bad news is that, yes, it's exactly as we predicted. Biden is confronting China, but they're rather better about it in terms of not alienating or even deliberately pissing off allies. And as a result, the situation is ratcheted up a notch. You know, we should have seen this coming, but I don't think very many people did. In other words, you're right. The situation is getting worse by intention. And it's a bipartisan sort of right. Let's make this happen. If there's going to be a, you know, confrontation over major issues, let's make it happen. Now, the contradiction, if there is one, in the Biden administration's approach is that they're also taking, as you say, a bit more of an industrial policy and economic nationalism tack to the economy, which could also serve the effect of alienating erstwhile allies in the standoff with China, particularly in Asia, you know, particularly South Korea, Taiwan, what have you, Australia, and also, of course, Europe. I would be more worried about that if the Chinese weren't so, the Chinese government wasn't so, I guess, ham-handed about retaliating in every direction and making enemies of people who I don't think really, you know, they'd rather stay in the middle, like Germany being the classic example. They'd rather not have to choose a side. And I think China's diplomatic quote-unquote actions are sort of making them choose a side. So this could play out in any number of ways, but the point is, the takeaway is, yeah, things are getting worse. And there are very good reasons to be concerned about decoupling between China and the West. And as always, the jetliner business is the dedicated hostage in that trade-off.
Ron, let me get your take on this, right? Because the street, you know, on the one hand, the street, you know, talks about patriotism and, you know, let's do the right thing and China's a problem. On the other hand, right, everybody is making a lot of money doing this, right? I mean, China is brilliant at using its market and, you know, their conviction is, right, that all these countries will, you know, basically slit their own throats to do business with us, right? I mean, ultimately, that's what will break discipline in this. I can exact so much economic pain on you, or my market is so attractive, you will always knuckle under to me. And we've seen that, right? People were sanctioning Hong Kong. What did they do? They transferred mainland IPOs to Hong Kong and are allowing Goldman, Morgan, and other leading banks from around the world to represent them. So all of a sudden, people are financially vested in it. And then they're saying, hey, you know, if you want to do business on the mainland, we're going to make it more attractive for you. How is this playing out from a financial community standpoint? And is this going to be something which is going to be, you know, that eventually people want to make money in China? So, right, the Boeing, I mean, even major defense contractors are lobbying against the government to, you know, against creating domestic sources of supply for things like rare earth elements or rare earth products, because it's cheaper to buy them from China. How's this going? How's this going to go?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen an evolution. I think if you look at China 20 years ago, 25 years ago, you know, it was the growth market. And then I would say probably over the last 6 years, 7 years, you've started to see a bit of an evolution. It started before the Trump administration. But for sure, you know, one of the big discussions on the street today is re-onshoring, right? You're seeing it happen.
Right.
And, you know, particularly in the industrial sector, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, what that means, the CapEx spend, what it means for supply chain suppliers. So just, you know, one quick example, you know, first you had TSMC say they were going to build a facility in Arizona. Then Intel said, oh, you know what, we're going to actually make a big facility too, because we got to, you know, reinvest in the chip business and the, you know, the microprocessor business. And then I think late last week, there was some news in the press in Asia that Foxconn is going to build a facility in Arizona. I don't know why Arizona, but Arizona seems to be a hotbed for this stuff right now. And then when you build those facilities, there's a whole, you know, all the companies that make all the manufacturing, machining, the automation, all that stuff. There's a whole big, giant CapEx cycle behind that. And we're seeing more and more of that, right? So I think the street is becoming more aware and betting on, in fact, a re-onshoring cycle for specific things, right? Not for everything, but it's definitely changing, right? So I think it really depends on, you know, the industry you look at. In finance, it's harder for me to say. You know, some banks have much bigger presences in, you know, on the mainland and in Hong Kong than other banks. So it just kind of depends on what they're doing. But it's not, I guess I'm saying this, it's not the same old story, right? I mean, there's definitely been a change, and the change has been accelerating in the streets, I think, adjusting to it.
Sash, this is a bit of a challenge for the UK as well, right? I mean, Boris Johnson was fond of saying, and he even said during the integrated review, right, that he remains a Sinophile at the end of the day. But the entire trade picture is looking a little bit different for the UK as well, right? The United States saying it's not really a priority for me to strike a trade deal with the UK. That was something which London was hoping would happen sooner rather than later. And in fact, the way Brexit is unfolding and what's happening in Northern Ireland has Washington's negative attention, unfortunately, at this moment. How do you see sort of this global trade dynamic unfolding and how it impacts the industry, and potentially how does it impact the United Kingdom?
It's not just a UK issue. You know, if you want the country in Europe that is most embedded in China and depends most on trade with China, into China and from China, that's Germany. You know, Germany has deep relations all across the heavy and light industrial spectrum, from, you know, autos to machine tools. You know, similarly, France, the UK would have, frankly, if it had more industry. I mean, the UK is very much at the light and invisible ends of the market. Now, you know, decoupling is very, very uncomfortable for Europe, and I think that European countries individually will drag their heels slightly in this whole process, because they can't cope with the damage to GDP if relations with China just, you know, were cut off suddenly. That's an unfortunate fact, but there's no way that you would get individual European countries doing that. It would, you know, cause, you know, similar levels of economic damage to what we've seen from COVID. You know, the whole international trade environment just looks much, much harder. And in that respect, it's going to be very interesting to see what the civil aircraft market looks like over the next 10 years. I mean, to come back to one of the points that we were, you know, discussing earlier on Suez and the blocking of the Gulf of Suez, my guess would be that that's actually going to be pretty positive for air freight. You know, there's a huge amount of stuff in those tankers that you cannot air freight because it's just prohibitively expensive. But stuff that you can and stuff that you need, you will fly. So the one group of companies that have been doing well through the whole COVID pandemic have been air freight companies and the companies that supply and service them. So if you are overhauling engines for 747 freighters and 767 freighters, 777 freighters, you're making like a bandit at the moment. I guess that that's got another 12 to 18 months plus to run, because there's no alternative in terms of belly cargo. So I think that's one of the areas that I think will do well. But in terms of sales of new civil aircraft, you know, part of the bull case for Boeing this time a year ago was eventually the Chinese will come back and buy a ton of aircraft. You know, they'll come back and they'll take all the MAXes that they've got on order, even though they're all hidden in the sort of the undisclosed area. They'll then buy a whole bunch of wide bodies as well, because, you know, they haven't ordered any recently. I think that's for the birds now. I think that the Chinese they probably, you know, they're trying to work out what capacity they need, but it's very hard to escape the conclusion that, that the capacity they don't need is stuff that involves buying more stuff from Boeing and the US at the moment.
Yeah, but if the China, if Beijing is as angry with Brussels as it is over going along with the U.S. sanctions on Xinjiang, and right, global economic pressure is driving commercial firms to say, I'm not going to buy Xinjiang cotton, right? I mean, some of this is being organized by the U.S. government, but a lot of it is just, it just plays really badly worldwide. What are the implications when the Chinese economic gunsight is as focused on Airbus as it is on Boeing, ultimately?
Well, it isn't yet. And the difference between Airbus and Boeing is that Airbus has been manufacturing aircraft, or at least assembling aircraft in China for the last 15 years. And that's how Airbus got from a sub 20% market share to an over 50% market share. If the Chinese need capacity, and I think it's an if at the moment, although, you know, the airlines have put aircraft back into service with astonishing speed and efficiency, but if they need capacity, then they're, you know, the least worst option is to take some from Tianjin in the next, you know, 2, 3, 4 years. After that, they have domestic, you know, domestic options. They've, you know, they'll have the C919, you know, even the ARJ21 if they really want that. It's going to take them another 10 years to produce a wide body, but there's tons of wide body capacity around.
We've got a couple of minutes left. I want to focus on the integrated review. Sash, you did a great estimate as to what was going to be included. Obviously, we had the integrated review and then the Defense Command paper, which were the specifics of sort of the 16, you know, where some of the $16 billion in cuts would come from to help underwrite the $16 billion in increases or strategic reinvestment, right? One was a black hole that needed to be paved. So we are seeing Tranche 1 Eurofighters retired, as you said, C-130 being retired, the Army being curtailed. Exactly as you said, you know, was speaking to a senior European officer, a friend of mine, who lamented a little bit at the reduction in the British Army, even though they're an airman. Right. And they were saying, you know, that the British Army is so key to almost everything we do in NATO. Talk to us about the nuclear weapons increase, which is something that British officials have suggested the U.S. administration wanted to see. The Trump administration may have wanted to see that. It's not abundantly clear whether the Biden administration wanted to see that as it undertakes its own nuclear posture review, even though it has shown a commitment to the nuclear triad. And was the government specific enough about where the money is going to go to at the end of the day?
Last question first. Of course they weren't. The UK has got the worst disclosure of the defense budget of any major Western nation, period. They never, ever say, you know, what is being spent where, budget line items that you'd get in the Green Book every year. The French Loi de Programmation is a absolutely fantastic piece of disclosure. The Italians have got stunning defense budget disclosure. UK, not within a million miles of it. It's very, very regrettable. It's not it's not a good look. So we don't know exactly where stuff is going. On the other hand, you can start to look at broad numbers in terms of what is and isn't being spent. I'll deal with a couple of those points. First of all, nuclear weapons. The UK doesn't bring nuclear weapons back into service on a whim or because some guy who was the last president asked us to. We do it. Any nation would only do something like that because the optics are very, very difficult indeed in terms of politics, especially concerning non-proliferation treaty. That's only being done for two reasons. One, because we've been asked to, and I understand it's because there are problems in terms of the maintenance cycle for the US Ohios at the moment. So there is a forecast shortage of submarine launched warheads over the next 5 to 8 years. And adding back warheads and missiles to the UK Trident fleet is one way to cover that. And secondly, and probably more structurally, there's clearly been a major assessment of the ability of the UK Trident fleet to actually hit its targets, to actually, you know, to achieve the deterrent that this is intended to do. And Russian anti-ballistic missile capabilities have clearly come along massively in the last 5 to 8 years or so, such that now the existing UK Trident fleet can't actually hold Moscow or, you know, another two major Russian cities hostage in the way that was assumed when the UK cut its number of installed warheads. And if you think about it, you know, the Russians have gone from, the ABM system, the SA-10 ABM system, then you went to S-200, S-300, S-400. The Russians have been incrementally improving their very, very high-end air defense capabilities, and they're far better than they were even 10 years ago. That has an implications for the UK, the UK nuclear weapons installed base. Back to the integrated review itself, our view is that, you know, this dodged some of the really difficult questions. Fundamentally, the UK armed forces are going to look pretty similar to what they did before the announcement of the integrated review and the command white paper, just smaller. Effectively, everything has been salami sliced very slightly. There are a couple of, scalps. The C-130s, which I have personally been involved in for an extremely long time in two sides of my profession, those are going, but, it's a 60-year-old aircraft and A400M can do the job just as well. But, small cuts to the Army's armored vehicle base, but the Army is still trying to be a full spectrum armed, Army. That's very difficult when you can fit the entire British Army, into a major football stadium. I can't see that being, but it's still got pretensions to all of the heavy armor, artillery, special forces, and so forth that you would expect from even from the US Marines, which is double the size, let alone another major country. So I think it's been a difficult review to actually look at and think, yeah, they've made all the right decisions. What comes out of it? Shipbuilding. The Royal Navy is going to be bigger at the end of this decade than it is now. Probably, bigger by about 20%. Royal Navy, shipyards associated with the Navy around the UK are going to have a ton of work over that period. That's a net win, because there's going to be, there's another class of frigates coming along, as well as the Type 31Es, as well as the Type 26Es. There's going to be a new family of destroyers coming along in the next decade, a complete rebuild of the amphibious fleet. Problem is, I'm not sure what we're going to put on the amphibious fleet, but still, that's going to be a big shipbuilding program. And so, that's very, very good for the two big quoted prime contractors, BAE Systems and Babcock. And if you want the big winner in terms of, heavy armor, Rheinmetall ends up supplying 2/3 of all the Army's armor. And that's an astonishing position for a company that had a pretty marginal position in the UK 10 years ago.
I want to sort of take it to F-35 really quickly. The record number still remains 138 for British, for the United Kingdom. But 48 is the number that are now under contract, and nobody has gone beyond the 48 number. There's 2 billion extra pounds for the Tempest program. I know I've asked you this before, but it's worth asking on a rolling basis. Any change in your forecast or estimate, Sash? I mean, does this get to 72 or something like that, and that's where it ends up?
I think it probably gets to about 60. What was very interesting, if you want the single most photographed piece of equipment in both white papers, it was an aircraft carrier, which tells you that is what the UK sees as being totemic, the most important piece of defence equipment. And also, the photographs are just terribly good. But definitely a commitment.
They're very photogenic ships, saying. Go ahead.
Yes, but definitely a commitment to keep both aircraft carriers in service through the period, which is much more punchy than had been, worried about, let's say, 6 months ago, when there was worry that it might be one in reserve, one in service, one in reserve, one in service, or even that one of them would be sold off altogether and we just keep one aircraft carrier like the French do. But no, it's going to be two aircraft carriers, on which basis we almost certainly need, I would say, another dozen F-35s, take the fleet up to 60. That would give a full 36 aircraft on whichever aircraft carrier is in full service at the time, and the ability to put another another dozen, 18 on another one in extremis. But 138, you know, that's that really is one for the birds. I think anybody who thinks we're going to buy 138, given the commitment to Tempest, is, you know, on some sort of hallucinogenic substance.
I just want to wrap this up really quickly and bring both Ron and Richard into it. What did each of you make of the review and what the outlook for F-35 is, right? I mean, because support for the program is somewhat more than somewhat charged back. You know, there's a senior retired friend of mine who is as unvarnished as it gets and is as neutral an observer of these things. And he said, look, I mean, the airplane can do things no other jet on the planet can do, end of story. So it's a massive capability increase. And you have to understand that in the cost per flying hour or for anything else that goes with the jet. And, you know, it is something that's just now coming into service and we'll manage to do a better job over time. And there will be upgrades to it as well, whether for power plant or for anything else over the years. Richard, want to get your sense and then Ron yours.
But, yeah,
and,
you know,
and especially especially what it might mean at a time when the United States is looking to make tough choices of its own, right? What Britain always does is shows the United States you can actually make tough choices. You can actually get rid of stuff. These are no easier for British constituencies as they are for American constituencies at the end of the day as well. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing about the F-35 is that production numbers and other, you know, overall program health numbers don't really depend upon anything extant right now. It's been a very long time since the F-35 has actually lost a competition or seen numbers in the U.S. fall due to procurement of something else. Really, what we're talking about is the impact of F-35 perceptions on development of follow-on systems. And nowhere is that more true than Britain, whether or not there are, you know, I suspect for reasons of carrier operations that Sasha's number is right, 60, maybe 72 on the upside. But the remainder of the 138, a lot of them were going to be RAF planes. And therefore, we're discussing Tempest right now. And just as in the U.S., everything that has to do with the continuation of 90 or 100 F-35s per year for domestic customers depends upon NGAD, development of an all-new system, anything like that. So has anything really been accelerated? You know, maybe Tempest, but for reasons having nothing to do with F-35. NGAD, maybe, we don't know. You know, there might be something in the black world that could threaten F-35 procurement in the outer years of the decade. But in terms of here and now, nothing has really changed. And if you look at, you know, nowhere is this more true than the F-35B. You know, if you look at what it brings to the table, it is that dream combination of supersonics, a really good mission equipment package, and a fantastic radar. And, oh, by the way, it's vertical. Is it expensive? Right. Yeah, you know, you're going to get, that's going to be expensive. But from the B standpoint, that's as safe a plane as you're going to find.
And it is an extraordinary capability at the end of the day that the South Koreans, Japanese, Australians, right? I mean, nation after nation, Italians, UK, and I suspect that there might be a couple more buyers of that ultimately, right? I mean, the Indian Air Force could probably use those as well in some capacity. Ron, you want to wrap us up for the week?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I agree with Richard. I mean, all your comments. I mean, it's a very capable airplane. You know, anyone anywhere can try to spin their previous generation product that it can kind of, you know, do most of it or whatever. But the simple fact is nothing exists today that is as capable. And there's nothing that we know of in the white world, meaning non-classified, that is going to challenge it for at least another 10 or 15 years. So, you know, that being the case, I think it's really the only show in town.
All right, guys, thanks very much. 3, 2, 1. Guys, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope you guys have a great day. Hope our audience has a great Passover. Have a tremendous week and looking forward to having you guys back on again next week. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Vago. Always great to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much, Vago.
Yeah, always a treat. Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.